The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
We at the Fed need to keep our foot on the gas until we're really sure that we're through this, and that's certainly our intention. The more we do now, the stronger our economy will be, the better we're able to keep people working, get tax revenue back up, and have a strong economy to pull us forward and service the debt. We're going to come out of this with more debt, so our banks are going to have taken losses, households will have run down their capital, everybody will. Nonetheless, the economy will be stronger, and that'll help everyone.
We should really just go around the world and talk about what we're seeing. Regionally, it's ebbing and flowing, but globally, the pandemic is marching on. And if you look at the data, and experts say we're 6 months in and the coronavirus is winning. In Asia, as you mentioned there, China, South Korea, these were places that in the beginning contained those local outbreaks. They're now seeing a resurgence. We spoke about this all week in terms of what Beijing is doing, in terms of halting some flights and having children go back to virtual learning. In Europe, Germany is really the one to be concerned with at the moment. A meatpacking plant had hundreds of workers test positive. They tested over 1,000 workers, and 730 of them came back positive. Latin American era, which at one point was really shed early on from the pandemic, is really the new epicenter, especially Brazil. And then, as you mentioned, the United States, it's these Sun Belt states. It's Texas, it's Florida, it's Arizona. They're seeing higher hospitalization numbers, and they're seeing higher case numbers. The worry is, what does this do to the hospital capacities? And there's a critical limitation, and we know, and that is, of course, hospital staff.
A big medical breakthrough in the fight against coronavirus has identified a drug that could have saved thousands of lives had it been used from an early stage in the pandemic. The research, led by a team of scientists at Oxford University, shows that dexamethasone, a familiar steroid that's been in use for 60 years, can be remarkably effective. The drug cuts the risk of death by a third for patients on ventilators and by a fifth for those requiring oxygen.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, good economic news coming out this week helped keep major indexes in positive territory. The leading economic indicators from the Conference Board increased by 2.5% last month. Retail sales jumped over 18%, and the unemployment claims keep coming down. The question is the economy on the road to recovery? Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up on today's program, Gina Martin Adams, head equity strategist from Bloomberg, will be joining me. Gina believes the market is entering a new phase where economic recovery and earnings will be the catalyst to drive stock prices higher, which makes, in her words, for more volatile markets ahead as the monetary phase has run its course. She still sees bargains in the stock market, especially considering that two-thirds of the S&P 500 are still trading below their book value, and she also sees values in the international markets. But the one space that looks overpriced is technology. Robert Rapier also will be joining me later on. He sees a weak recovery in oil prices, and believe it or not, he thinks big oil is about ready to go green. In today's big picture, we'll look at phase two, relapse or recovery, as we go into depth on issues that will drive or reshape today's economy and markets for investors. But first, let's look at the news driving markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Thanks, Jim. This week can be categorized as a tug of war between fears of a resurgence of COVID-19 versus economic news supporting recovery efforts and continued support from the government and the Federal Reserve Bank. Now, so we started off the week with a continuation of profit-taking on Monday based on reports that early open states were seeing a resurgence of COVID cases, in addition to news that Beijing had locked down a wholesale market and nearby housing based on an outbreak there. Now, buyers began to step in at this point. You know, we had that major correction last week, a dip of 6% on Thursday. So presented some opportunities for anybody sitting on the sidelines. And so that took place and then was supercharged by news. That day, the Federal Reserve was updating its secondary market corporate credit facility to include the purchase of individual corporate bonds that fit certain minimum rating and maximum maturity criteria. With buyers of the dip and news from the Fed, the S&P index that day was down 2.5% at most, but finished the day up 0.8%, which pretty much set the tone for the week.
There was yet another game of tug of war on Tuesday with economic data from retail sales right out the bat in the morning for May in the U.S. that jumped 17.7% from April's 14.7% decline. So a huge swing there, showing that pent-up demand was able to work itself out as reopening efforts continue. And then Bloomberg reported that President Trump was preparing a $1 trillion infrastructure proposal. And no telling if that would get through, as there's also consideration that the Senate and the House may be doing a fourth relief bill. But who knows? It definitely the market appreciated the news. But things simmered down based on tempered testimony before Congress by Federal Reserve Chairman Powell, who said the recovery will be long and slow. He did, however, confidently attest the Fed will be proactive in supporting the financial markets and that they are prepared to cap yields at certain points along the yield curve. So that was kind of some new information there. And that news caused the financial sector to turn negative for the day. So those were really the key catalysts on the week between Monday and Tuesday, as more or less similar stories carried out throughout the week, with some positive economic news tempered by continued resurgence in COVID-19 news in select states, as well as progress in Beijing on the downside. I think they shut down schools as well after that wholesale market outbreak. It's worth mentioning some of the economic news, as these are the key catalysts we view as supportive of the market right now. Those include an increase in the Conference Board's leading economic index, which was up 2.8% in May, an unexpected jump in the Philadelphia Fed index to 27.5. That's a positive number from last May's negative 43.1. So huge swing there. Total housing starts increased 4.3% in May, and building permits, which is kind of forward leading, were up a solid 14.4%. On the flip side, initial jobless claims were unexpectedly higher and still very high at 1.5 million for last week's data. One last item to mention was a CNBC interview with famed investment strategist Jeremy Grantham. I believe that was on Wednesday, who is known for calling three major market bubbles: Japan's asset-priced bubble of 1989, the dot-com bubble in 2000, and the housing crisis of 2008. He said he thinks the market rally from March may be the fourth major bubble in his career, citing a steady flow of stimulus, which may be providing the favorable environment for speculation. When asked what should an investor do with their U.S. exposure to stocks, he said a good number might be zero, and less than zero might not be a bad idea. His comments give many pause and helped settle the S&P 500 down 0.4% on the day, again on Wednesday. He did, however, say that great bubbles can go a long time and inflict a lot of pain. But at least I think we know now that we're in one, is what he said. So it's not clear on the timing when he thinks it will burst, but back to his allocation, I think that speaks a lot on his position and recommendation right now. Now, even though it didn't affect the market like Jeremy Grantham's interview, there was a memo from another famed investor, Howard Marks of Oak Tree Capital, this week, who said, and I quote, "The powerful rally we've seen has been built on optimism, has incorporated positive expectations and overlooked potential negatives, and has been driven largely by the Fed's injection of liquidity and the Treasury stimulus payments, which investors assume will bridge to a fundamental recovery and to be free from highly negative second-order consequences." He finished with this, I thought was very interesting. "The fundamental outlook may be positive on balance, but with listed security prices where they are, the odds aren't in investors' favor." So in other words, calling the market overvalued. His words seem to echo the same comments from Jeremy Grantham concerning valuations here, but like Grantham, Marx also recognizes that while overpriced, it's not necessarily synonymous with sure to decline, which we've seen Stanley Druckenmiller and David Tepper deal with their calls way back in May. That's why I spend so much time every week trying to identify the catalyst. It's not the news that matters, but the market's response to the news. What grips investors most? Stimulus? Virus outbreaks? Vaccine progress? Presidential polling, maybe rioting, etc. You know, it's always going to be something out there. There's always news, but it's how does the market interpret it? I'll continue to do my best to provide that news each week. And that's it for this week's report. Jim, back to you with the week's technician, one of my favorite out-of-box thinkers, Gina Martin-Adams from Bloomberg.
FS Insider caught up with the notable forecaster, Martin Armstrong, this week to talk about two very important calls that he's made on our show. One of them being last year when he said that the upcoming U.S. elections would be very likely the most violent in U.S. history and compared them to what we saw in the 1960s. He made that prediction when we spoke with him last year. So we got an update from him on that and what he expects to take place within the framework of the five stages of revolution and what that means going forward, especially after the U.S. elections in November. The second call that we caught up with him on was the one he made on our show last time in March when he said that the market would likely bottom at the end of March and then see a very strong bounce back up until July of this year. So we also got an update on his market outlook as well to get his thoughts on where he thinks the market is headed now. Here's a preview of that interview when we spoke to him this week on FS Insider.
The Dow still has a risk of making a new low. Probably not the NASDAQ or the S&P, but you'll then pull back, retest, maybe going into September, October, because, you know, fundamentally, maybe they're going to try another second lockdown. We look at it from our model creates these buy and sell signals. It's the old brick and mortar establishments that have taken it really on the chin. So the Dow can still make a new low. It has never gotten above our weekly buy signal, whereas the NASDAQ did. So it's a shift completely in what is going up and what is going down.
To hear this full interview with the notable forecaster Martin Armstrong on FS Insider, in addition to our three other interviews airing every week through our website or through a podcast app of your choice on your mobile device, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com.
Well, the markets have gone up as quickly as they have fallen. I guess a big question going forward is, will they continue to go up as the economy improves? Joining us on the program from Bloomberg is Gina Martin Adams, equity strategist. Gina, let's talk about the stock market and the economy. We all know that in the second quarter, you know, the economic numbers aren't looking as good because that's when most of the pandemic hit. We also know corporate earnings aren't going to be that much or go along with those economic numbers. Let's talk about what this looks like going forward as state after state begins to open up. I know in California today, we went back to wearing masks because we're having a number of outbreaks. But what's your opinion in terms of the economy and the markets going forward?
Yeah, so thank you, first of all, for having me on the podcast again. It's always a delight to work with you. But in terms of our outlook for the equity market, I see the market transitioning to a new phase. And what I mean by that is, from the March low to date, the movement in price is entirely explained by valuation expansion, and according to our model, entirely explained by extraordinary monetary accommodation through the reduction in interest rates, the expansion in the balance sheet, the compression in credit spreads. All of those factors have been somewhat driven by monetary support. That in combination with the fiscal support, which is obviously sheltering the economy from much worse declines, really stimulated the market rally starting in March. However, as of late May, early June, our models suggested, well, the valuation expansion phase of this rally is largely coming to an end. We had repriced based upon the extraordinary monetary accommodation, based upon the extraordinary policy infusion, and we're moving into a new phase. We're moving into a phase, in my mind, where stuff climb gets a lot rockier. It's not a one-way trade. It's a trade more based on the rate of improvement or the rate of perceived improvement in economic growth into 2021. Now, the lucky thing is expectations are extremely low. So it should, what we should see over the course of the next several months is expectations are low enough that even just incremental improvements in the economy should get embedded into forward earnings estimates and create at least a stabilization, if not an uptrend in earnings expectations, which should power stocks higher. However, it remains to be seen. And that's a somewhat uncomfortable position for all of us to be in. We've already repriced. Now we have to see the economic data sort of show us that we are starting to show some improvement, and that should power the next leg of stocks higher.
Yeah, the market seems to be focused on one thing in particular. We've had economic fiscal stimulus. We've had monetary stimulus. On the day you and I are speaking, the economic indicators ticked up. Retail sales look good. I guess it's just a question, does that continue going forward as more economies open up?
It is the question. And just for a bit of historical perspective, it's also completely normal for the stock to behave this way. And by that, I mean, we reached a number of technical triggers. As of the end of May, we were finally surpassing our 200-day moving average as a good example. We finally got to the point where 90% of stocks in the S&P were trading above their 50-day moving average. Historically, those trigger points result in a shift in market character to a much slower rate of appreciation over the subsequent 3 to 6 months. If you go back to the 2016 market recovery as a good example, we obviously had a really difficult market in 2015, 2016. We finally hit our lows in February 2016. Stocks started climbing at a relatively rapid rate, led by, you know, high volatility, high value sorts of stocks, very consistent with the type of environment that we've been in. Obviously, this is unique in its own right because it was a unique economic crisis. But nonetheless, the pattern is very similar. Once we crested that 200-day moving average in 2016, as is consistent with historical averages, the market shifted a little bit. The summer of 2016, you may recall, we moved into more of a sideways trend until we got to the election, which sparked that next rally. So it's a relatively decent proxy for kind of what to expect is you see this really robust rip higher, valuations re-rate based upon policy infusion. We saw that in 2009 as well. We even saw it in 1932-33. Policymakers create this bottom in stocks. Sentiment is extremely low. We rip higher. Everything moves higher. High volatility and junk stocks lead the trade. And then eventually you get to a point where you move into a new character. And I just think that's the point. It becomes a show me market. You know, okay, great. We've re-rated. Show me that that's worthwhile. And it's just a more rocky climb. Leadership transitions a little bit instead of extremely high volatility, high value sort of leadership. It becomes a little bit more mixed. That's reflected in our sector scorecard as well, which is less cyclically biased, just a more mixed kind of market outlook and really dependent more on the fundamental recovery.
Let's bring in another factor. I mean, if we take a look at 2020, if we were having this conversation in January, I don't think any of us could have foreseen COVID, the riots, the impeachment. All these things have happened in the first 6 months of the year. When we get into the second half of the year, as we're looking for, okay, we've had the stimulus, we got rates at almost zero. Does this take go forward? But what about the impact of the election as we head into the fall? Because obviously there's different philosophies between both parties this election year.
Yeah, there are a lot of key issues I think you want to consider in terms of the election. But again, I go back to my 2016 corollary where stocks went through a period of time pre-election, a very, very volatile sort of period of time with a lot of turmoil with respect to the two candidates, very different candidates at that point in time as well. And it was until after the election where we finally got our relief rally. So I wouldn't be at all surprised to see something similar. I think there are some very big similarities and there are very big differences on the part of these candidates. A couple of things we're certainly watching for. One is trade policy, sort of what is rhetoric versus policy with respect to how we're going to navigate trade relations globally is probably going to be pretty consequential to corporate profitability. You know, another thing to consider is tax policy. Will we see a rollback of corporate tax cuts? There already is a plan into the future for 2022, 2023, some rollback of the corporate tax cuts that were enacted in late 2017 going into 2018. So what are we going to see with respect to corporate tax policy? That's going to be really consequential potentially to corporate profitability and could certainly create a lot of turmoil. Healthcare is another issue. It's obviously been a big leader in the market in 2020. Healthcare stocks have been roaring back after sort of hitting a period of dormancy since the 2016 election season. Will we see major changes to how we pay for healthcare in this country going into 2021? How will the candidates approach healthcare? The other thing I think you want to watch for, and this is not necessarily related to the election, but really more related to near-term fiscal policy action, is there's a possibility that we get either an extension of the unemployment benefits program or other programs designed to boost the economy sometime within the next several months. Not necessarily related, but maybe peripherally related to the election. Will we get an infrastructure package is something that I think we want to consider into the next 6 months. So the election will matter. Certainly fiscal policy will absolutely matter. And let's not forget about monetary policy as well, because we're not completely settled on our monetary policy approach. The Fed is still apparently considering potential yield curve control. What will that mean for the financial sector in particular? What will it mean for rates and spreads? They continue to expand the corporate bond purchases, which is obviously very supportive of spreads, and some of the lower quality companies in the S&P 500, will that shift? So there's certainly a lot to watch for with respect to policy action out of Washington, potentially impacting the equity market as well.
Gina, what about the extension of the PPP plan? I mean, originally it was 8 weeks. Now I think they've extended it to 24, because one of the areas of the economy that has been impacted the most has been a lot of these small businesses. And of course, we've seen, you know, some difficulty with some of the writing and things like that, where a lot of small businesses have been harmed. Do you think perhaps there's an extension of that program or additional funds to help small businesses? I mean, it seems like every single week you're hearing a retailer, an energy company, here locally, some of the big gyms have gone under. So a lot of these businesses that have been shut down as a result of the economy have been impacted.
Yeah. I think anything's on the table at this point. I think most of the complaints about the PPP have been in through its design. So I think that there are a lot of potential improvements to be made in design and the allocation of those funds to businesses. But I do think that there is tremendous recognition on the part of policymakers in Washington that this is an extraordinary experience. It's not a normal recession by any stretch of the imagination. It's a recession that was brought on by a healthcare crisis, where authorities had to shut down economies to cripple businesses. And so the byproduct of that is there is a natural recognition on the part of the authorities, the policymakers, that we will need to see potentially new supports emerge, especially as we go through the process of experimenting with reopening. I know there's a lot of concern out there about a second wave, and we've been on the tape suggesting that a second wave is not something to worry about to the degree that we worried about the first wave, because we went through the first wave. And policymakers recognize the implications of economic shutdowns. They recognize the turmoil that is created by shutting economies, and we presumably have learned from that experience to some degree. So I do think that policymakers are on board with trying to find the supports necessary. And as with anything, your first time out is never perfect. You know, the first solution is oftentimes not the best solution. You have to iterate on this. This is something that we learned in the 2007 to 2009 crisis period. You know, the Fed's first attempts at resolving liquidity conditions were simply not enough. So they went back to the drawing board. They continued to go back to the drawing board to find that appropriate solution over time. I think we have to be open to the prospect that that same sort of environment is potentially emerging now, where if we can't find our way to dig out of this recessionary process, more than likely the policymakers will come to the table and bring a new program that is hopefully takes the lessons of the last several months and results in a program that's better designed to attack the issues of the day.
Gina, what are the chances of a policy mistake? And I'm thinking just going back in history in the 30s, when you took a look at the New Deal programs, they got rid of deflation, the stock market took off for almost a five-year period, the economy picked up, and then in 1937, the Fed raised interest rates, they raised tax rates, and we were right back in a slump again. Yeah. What are the chances of a policy mistake? Like, for example, you talked about you're going to be watching trade policy, taxes, because if, let's say, companies aren't realizing the sales or the profits that they had before COVID, and then all of a sudden you raise the tax rates from 21 to 28%, obviously that's going to hurt earnings, and also it could impact the economy. What's the chances of a policy mistake?
I would say the chances are unusually high. However, I think, if anything, at this moment in time, our policy mistakes would be more geared to erring on the side of caution. If we make a policy mistake, it's that, in my opinion, we hold on too long and we stimulate too much and then fail to take it back fast enough. And the result is a potential inflationary breakout. And I know that that sounds completely bizarre to talk about at this moment in time, given the deflationary pressures that we're dealing with. But I do think that at some point you have to really consider, well, how much do you need to take back? Because we've been fighting the quote unquote deflationary crisis since 2008. That's a very, very long period of time to have extraordinary policy accommodation, like continuously infusing liquidity into the market. And I do have some questions as to at what point does that finally result in, you know, conditions that are entirely different and that we are completely unprepared for as an investor universe. I'm more worried about the monetary policy side than the fiscal policy side. I think oftentimes it's much more difficult to get fiscal policy action. But on the monetary policy side, you know, I think what you could very well see is this sort of confluence of events where we maintain extremely accommodative monetary policy for an extraordinary period of time. We wait a little bit too long for the economy to bounce back. At the same time, companies are thinking about really altering their supply chain, diversifying their supply chain, which is going to inherently increase cost in the system. So you've got this combination of potential, you know, supply chain disruptions that are on a more permanent basis that keep constraints on supply and recovering demand and extraordinary monetary policy. And that could result in a lot of inflation volatility that we haven't seen in a considerable period of time. Now, I want to keep my eye on the ball of fiscal policymakers, obviously, but even on that front, I think if we're still struggling economically, it's incredibly unlikely that fiscal policymakers are going to come together and do something that is restrictive. If anything, the fiscal policymakers also probably will remain too easy for too long. And the implications of that could be found in the Treasury market as well as the dollar. So I do think you want to keep an eye on policymakers and what they're doing broadly. I'd say because we've been in this environment of extraordinary policy action, we are absolutely, as an asset class, the equity market is absolutely more sensitive to a potential policy error than it has been in the recent past. And it does make me somewhat uncomfortable. I definitely want to keep an eye on it. I'm not tremendously worried about it right now, but I do think you want to be somewhat conscientious about that fact.
I think the one thing the market, and you just raised this, the one thing I don't think the market is anticipating or even ready for is a rise in the inflation level. If you look at coming out of 2009, with the Fed printing vast amounts of money, we really didn't experience a high level of inflation as many were predicting. But this time around, you actually have money that the government is putting into the hands of consumers versus staying on the balance sheet of the Fed. So let's talk about that for a minute, because I think that's the one thing the market does not anticipate here.
Yeah, I would totally agree with you. There's no anticipation that we're going to have a deflationary breakout. As a matter of fact, we're definitely on the entire other end of the spectrum where we're anticipating more of a permanent deflationary sort of malaise or lack of economic growth. And I do think there's something of a risk of an inflationary breakout. I brought up the supply chain issue because I do think that companies are starting to consider when you have really volatile and uncertain trade policy combined with this healthcare crisis, you'd get a natural sense that companies are going to really consider how they diversify their supply chains. They don't want to be inordinately dependent upon one region of the world in order to produce, even a component of their supply. So the result of that is going to be companies are probably going to spend to, you know, once the economic risk is clear, they're probably going to spend to diversify their supply chains. In the interim, you already have lots of friction in the supply chain. You know, I'm sure you've read in the news, just like I have, that certain categories of food prices are escalating at double-digit pace. So while we're not as a culture necessarily spending as much at restaurants, we're absolutely spending at the grocery store, and the supply and demand dynamics of that are resulting in inflationary breakouts already. You know, I think that there's a lot of angles that you want to consider. The other thing that I would consider is the fact that because of suppressed near-term oil prices, and this goes back to policy again, we have suppressed near-term oil prices right now, which is naturally creating a constraint on supply. Companies are not going to flood the market with a whole lot of oil and gasoline in an environment where you're constantly thinking that you have, you know, depressed economic conditions. On top of that, we may have policy change that directly inhibits the supply of traditional fossil fuels to the market. What does that do to inflationary conditions when we're all still driving gas-driven cars? You know, not a significant portion of the population has transitioned to electric just yet. So we do have enough demand. If we have constrained supply, naturally constrained supply on top of forced constrained supply through a policy lever, you can make a case that suddenly you have energy price inflation, which we haven't really contended with almost at all since 2011. So there's a lot of different angles to the inflation story that I think very few people are really focused on. It, as I said before, it's not something that I'm necessarily worried is going to topple the market outlook in the very near term, but I do think it's something you want to be on guard for and, you know, do some homework in advance to prepare for. How do you position your portfolio quite differently in an environment where inflation volatility may be rising and inflation expectations may be rising, because that's the polar opposite experience to that which we've been through for the last decade and change.
And finally, given this kind of environment, what would you be doing right here as an investor? Would you be building up some cash, maybe taking some profits, keeping some powder dry? Or are there areas that you think that are undervalued that deserve investor attention?
Yeah, I think within the U.S. equity market, I am an equity strategist, so I tend to be pretty optimistic that stocks over the long term are going to continue to rise. I do think that there are still pockets of opportunity. Many people look at the equity market and they see a 20% handle or a 20 handle on valuations, and they think that's just too cost prohibitive. Stocks are way too expensive. But when you actually start decomposing the equity market valuations, you find that 2/3 of stocks in the S&P 500 even are still trading at relatively discounted valuations, and that's based on a book value. So just on the book value of their asset, 2/3 of companies in the S&P 500 are trading at below 5-year average price to book. That's pretty extraordinary. So it tells you that the valuation excesses are very, very concentrated. Also, the valuation excesses is largely due to short-term suppression in earnings, which is going to change. I mean, if we just get the average earnings recovery following recession after the second quarter, we'll see a 15% reduction in our forward 2-year valuation multiple. So it tells you a lot about, you know, I think you just need to do your homework and find those values. But there are still, quite frankly, a lot of deep value opportunities, even in the U.S. market. I think in broader terms, there's a tremendous amount of opportunity in global stocks. I mean, U.S. stocks have re-rated much faster than most other areas of the world largely because of our policy infusion, as well as because of this sort of limited amount of risk tolerance on the part of investors. They want to go to the most defensive areas of the market and the areas they feel most comfortable with. But if you look across the world, stocks are still trading at near record levels of risk premium relative to bonds in the global realm. And that even includes the U.S. If you exclude the U.S., you've got a tremendous amount of discount available in global equities, particularly relative to the bond market. So I think there's still a tremendous, there's plenty of opportunity in stocks, both here and abroad. I think you just need to do your homework to find those opportunities.
Sounds to me like a stock picker's market. Gina, as we close, I know, you know, if you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can follow your work. Anybody listening to this program, is there another way they can follow you?
Yeah, sure. In addition to just finding me on Bloomberg and visiting our page on the Bloomberg, which is BI/STOX Go on Bloomberg, you can follow our work sort of peripherally on LinkedIn. I do try to post at least my weekly video, which I call the Equity Market Minute, on LinkedIn. I can't say that I'm religious about it. I'd give it a go. But you can always try to contact me on LinkedIn, follow me there, and hopefully get enough access that you get a pretty good sense of what we're thinking and working on.
All right. Well, listen, Gina, thanks so much for coming on the program. Stay safe. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
People really want to have efficient supply chains. They want it to be as efficient or lean as possible. Lean is a big word that is used in supply chain management these days. And another word for lean is brittle or weak. And I think that's really what's happening. And again, it goes to that paradigm shift. When you go from globalization to geopolitics, when you go from free trade to protectionism, the old system doesn't work. So you can have a lean supply chain, whether it's tech or food or all these other things, when everybody plays by the same rules, when there's an inherent, doesn't have to be perfect trust, but an inherent level of trust between most of the players that are in the system, and the supply and demand and price, all of that will determine where things go. That's not what's happening. The geopolitics is beginning to supplant the globalization, and the strategic decisions that major nations are making is beginning to block that. So if your supply chain was sort of built on just going to the most efficient point of the chain or the most efficient country in terms of cost, that's all breaking down because that lean supply chain was designed for an environment of international trust, of relative peace and harmony. That's gone now. I think that's the reason that things are breaking down, because it's nice to sort of thump your chest and say America first or Europeanization of supply chains. It's quite another thing to actually get down in the weeds and sort of make sure that those supply chains that before were completely dependent on that leanness and that flexibility, to make sure they have enough slack to account for a disruption. And I mean, COVID-19 was the mother of all disruptions, but there's going to be a lot more. I mean, it can manifest as geopolitical conflict between nations. It can manifest as disasters related to climate change. COVID-19 is just a little taste of what it looks like when you're in a global system where people don't trust each other and where people are more competitive. You have to get away from comparative advantage, and you've got to start thinking about political risk. You have to get away from, I need my supply chain as efficient and lean as possible, to, I need my supply chain to be resilient. I need it to be able to withstand a body blow and still keep going. And we're not there yet. We're not even close to there yet, because folks weren't preparing for that. Folks sort of thought the status quo was going to continue on for a while. And I guess this is the silver lining of COVID-19. It's basically a real wake-up call to say, look, if the world is trending in this direction, you have got to make major changes. That's everything from sort of how you conceptualize the concepts of supply chain and resilience and risks, all the way down to who is my supplier, what is a reliable supplier, how many backup suppliers do I need, do I know what my supplier is doing or where my supplier gets their supplies from, etc.
This was just a preview of our interview with Jacob Shapiro from Perch Perspectives, where we discuss the broad geopolitical landscape and how it is evolving in the wake of the COVID-19 crisis. Some of the things that we discuss in this interview are the process of globalization breaking down, how the world is breaking into rival economic blocks, and why it is no longer hyperbole, he says, to say that the US and China are now in a Cold War. To hear this full interview, in addition to our other 3 interviews airing every week on FS Insider through our website or through a podcast app of your choice on your mobile device, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
One One of the biggest and best performing sectors since the recovery began in the market has been energy. The question is, will the rally in energy stocks continue? Well, let's find out. Joining us on the program is Robert Rapier. Robert, let's begin with the price of oil on the day you and I are speaking. WTI is at 37, and some people say that we need to get into the $40, $50 range before these companies start making money.
Yeah, that's true for the most part. I mean, a lot of these companies, the majority of them probably will not make money at $37 oil, but they're getting close. I think ConocoPhillips is one of the ones that I think in their annual report, they put out that they could make a 10% return with oil prices at $40. And that's sort of what they were targeting for the long term. So they're probably close. There are probably a few other companies, maybe some of the major oil and gas companies are probably close at the current price. But I think most of the primarily shale drillers are not there at the current price.
You know, one of the stories that has come out as a result of COVID, there's less air travel. We've heard about Warren Buffett selling his airline stocks. And there was an article in the Journal the other day that what companies are finding is that they can do business. They don't have to put somebody on an airplane, send them to another city, hotel fares, meals, all those expenses. They can just as well do this versus, let's say, video conferencing. So what does that do for the demand for energy going forward? I know people are driving, but they're not flying as much.
Yeah, what I've said from the beginning is I thought this was going to have a real long-term impact on energy demand. And so I've cautioned people about jumping in and out of oil here because I really think we've got a long, hard road ahead of us. We're still, you know, I checked the EIA, I think we're still down about 20% on gasoline demand year over year. And I don't see a good, strong recovery of demand for quite a while. I think there is going to be, you know, as long as COVID is out there and we've sort of gotten onto a plateau now where we're, you know, still 20,000 new cases in the U.S. every day, people are not going to go out to restaurants. There's going to be traffic's going to be down on the roads. It's going to be down in some businesses. But right now, I think there's a real fundamental disconnect between what is actually happening in the economy and the stock market, which is looking further down the line and maybe seeing a recovery third, fourth quarter. And I just think that, you know, our response to COVID here with, you know, all these new cases still popping up, we're not really getting a handle on this. And I think that's going to be a drag on the economy until we do.
I mean, the Fed just came out on the day you and I are speaking saying they don't even plan on looking at raising interest rates to 2022. So, you know, even the Fed is saying this may be with us for quite some time.
Yeah, I saw Powell talking this morning, and that's one of the things he said was until the public is confident this pandemic is contained, a full economic recovery is unlikely. And yet the stock market has recovered to about where it was, you know, before it panicked, sold off in March. You know, the NASDAQ, I don't know where it is today, but it actually went above where it was in March. So, you know, I really think there's a real serious fundamental disconnect. Now, I think oil companies, the shares, especially the midstreams, I mean, the midstreams, there's been a lot of triple digit movers since the lows of March. And I don't think they should have been punished as much as they were. I think the last time we talked, we discussed midstreams a lot. And I say, look, they should not be subject to the same sort of volatility as oil prices because they've got longer term take or pay agreements. You know, they're toll collectors. They're not subject to a lot of direct exposure to oil and gas volatility. So these guys really oversold in March. And then, you know, some of them are up 150% since then. So they've corrected back into a pretty reasonable range. But, you know, some of the oil companies that sold off so much, they maybe are getting a little bit ahead of themselves now.
What about some of the big guys? Now, there was an article yesterday that the banks are cutting the shale drillers' lifelines in terms of renewing credit lines and things of that nature. And there's speculation that some of the bigger guys, the Chevrons, let's say the Exxons, who are moving into the shale space, that they may be there to pick up the pieces. Do you see that happening? Because we haven't seen any takeovers as many were expecting, given the low oil prices.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons for that is maybe look at what happened to Occidental when they took over Anadarko. Their share price was obliterated. You know, people didn't like that acquisition. They thought they overpaid for it. And I think any CEO of any major oil company has got to be a little bit hesitant of going out there and spending a lot to, you know, if they can acquire assets for pennies on the dollar, I don't think ExxonMobil cares what anybody thinks. I mean, ultimately in the long run, they'll say, you know, maybe we get punished, but, you know, we are creating long-term value. So, but I think shareholders are liable to punish some of these companies. I don't really want to see ConocoPhillips go out and make a big acquisition. Now, I wouldn't mind seeing somebody acquire ConocoPhillips. I own shares in ConocoPhillips, so I wouldn't mind seeing them gobbled up at a premium, but I don't want to see them go out and acquire somebody just because I fear what happened to Oxy. And Warren Buffett said recently, you know, that was a huge mistake. His investment that helped them make that acquisition, he has said he wishes he had that back.
Yeah, because didn't he? I think he had convertible preferreds, and he had to convert those shares or the preferreds into common stock because the company couldn't afford to pay him the preferred dividend.
Yeah.
So what happens to a company like Occidental? I mean, they used to be maybe not quite a major. They were right up there. They had some good assets, and then one acquisition completely destroyed the company.
Yeah, it's funny. I did write an article at Forbes a few months ago because somebody commented that, wow, you could acquire the Oxy Anadarko combination now for cheaper than Oxy paid for Anadarko. And I broke that down a little bit and I said, it's true. Market cap wise, that's true. But you'd also have to assume all that debt. And so the enterprise value, because that includes the debt, is actually higher. And so I said, that's the one piece people are missing. You couldn't just go out and, you know, acquire all the shares on the market. You would have to go in and make a deal and assume all that debt. So it would be a more expensive deal than it appears on the surface.
So what happens to a company like Oxy? They've cut their dividend. They've cut salaries. Buffett practically owns the company by converting his preferreds. And then you got Carl Icahn in there. These are two fairly smart guys, even though Buffett admitted it was a mistake. But what about Carl Icahn? I mean, he was in there buying shares all the way to the bottom.
Yeah, and sometimes these guys are just wrong. I mean, I remember when Warren Buffett unloaded his Phillips 66 shares, and they subsequently rose 30% after that, after he unloaded them. And so sometimes these guys are wrong on their timing. I wouldn't, you know, it's very speculative. A lot of these oil companies, people ask me, you know, would you buy Chesapeake here, or would you buy? And I said, just understand, it is highly speculative. You might see a windfall, but, you know, it kind of depends on what kind of investor you are. And the kind of investor I am, I'm more conservative. I'm looking for more certainty, and I'm willing to give up, you know, some of those home runs if I can avoid, you know, some of those total wipeouts. So, you know, I'm not investing in an Oxy or a Chesapeake or anything like that that I view as extremely high risk, but potentially high reward.
Let's move on to another topic, and this is related to COVID. There's a lot of stories coming out that we've reached peak demand in oil. Obviously, people aren't getting on airplanes like they used to. They're not getting in their cars, using their cars. I mean, here in San Diego, we have traffic jams, and for the first time, you know, traffic moves during the rush hour. So what about the idea that we've reached peak demand because clean energy, you know, 10 years from now, 5 years from now, you and I are going to be driving electric cars, and that the demand for oil has reached its peak and is downhill from here?
Yeah, I've covered that theme a few times, and I've just written a new article, you know, asking the question whether COVID helped permanently descale the fossil fuel industry. I don't know if we're at peak demand, but it makes it more likely. So what I foresaw before COVID came along, I foresaw oil demand growing for a few more years, maybe until 2030, before electric vehicles really started to take a deep bite and potentially cause oil demand to fall. But now, because we've had such a bite out of oil demand, it's going to be a few years now before it can crawl back to where it was. And by then, you know, we may be, you know, coming up the end of the decade, and you know, it's possible. It is possible that we've been accelerated into peak demand here. I don't think so, but I couldn't totally count it out.
What's going to happen to big oil companies if we are moving towards electric? I mean, people don't realize what oil is used for. It's used for, gosh, you look around your home, half the products in your home are made with some kind of derivative from oil, from pharmaceuticals to plastics. So there's a lot of other uses for oil. But what happens to the big oil companies? A recent article in the Financial Times is the big oil companies may not be so big. One of the majors is talking about becoming an electric utility. So where do we go from here with the big guys?
Yeah, I think there is still one growth area in, I think most people agree that the IEA and the EIA and most of those outlooks see natural gas as a growth, still a growth field until maybe 2050, these outlooks that go out that far. And I think that's probably correct. We will see, I think, more around the world coal shifting to natural gas. So a company like Shell, I think, is better positioned than some of the others because they have really gone all in on natural gas and LNG. I think in the long run, they'll be a little bit better positioned than a company that maybe is more oil-centric. But, I think a lot of these companies, they're investing in renewables, and they, if the future is electric cars, they're going to have a harder time. To the extent that we still need jet fuel and fuel for heavy transportation, I think there's still, some demand for oil. But I don't think it'll be where it was 20 years from now. I think we'll be down, and those companies are either going to have to adapt or go extinct.
Yeah, I just don't see, at least for the next 10 years, I mean, who knows what happens with technology, that you're going to get a 787 Dreamliner up in the air on solar panels some kind of other, or batteries for that matter. But as we start moving more towards electric cars, what about the other byproducts that we use for energy? I mean, look at the stuff that's in your home that is made from an oil-based product. Most people don't even understand that a lot of pharmaceuticals have an oil derivative in them.
Right. That's absolutely correct. And, we will still need those. The demand may be smaller. You know, oil may become more of a specialty chemical operation, converting oil into some of those petrochemicals that we need. You look around your house and there are all kinds of things that are made of oil, just, your carpet and your curtains and, the paint on the walls. I mean, those things are all derivatives of oil.
So given this and looking what's happening, it seems like some of the big guys, you have one of them, as you mentioned, Shell is going more towards natural gas as more new power plants are being powered by natural gas. Then you have one company, one of the big guys is moving towards becoming an electric utility. And then you have another company like Exxon that is saying, you know what, we're still going to need oil. And they've sort of bucked the trend of the majors and went in a direction towards exploration. They have the new discovery off Ghana. They've gone their own direction. So do you see each one of these big guys sort of taking a niche and going for it?
Yeah, and I think that's not surprising with ExxonMobil. They do what they know best, and I think they will stay that course. On the other hand, they have underperformed for years. I mean, Chevron has beaten them hands down for years, and part of that is just investor expectations, investors looking to, and seeing maybe a brighter future for Chevron than for Exxon. And that's the case in a lot of companies. There's a big psychological factor there that helps elevate some of these PEs on some of these companies. You can see an oil company that's generating as much cash flow as a technology company, but it trades at a fractional PE because it's just not seen as a kind of growth industry and have the brightest future as some of those technology companies.
So, I mean, you cover the energy space, you cover utilities. Where do you see us going in terms of energy? I mean, if we're all shifting, Robert, to electric cars, that means at night, instead of your gas engine car just sitting in the garage, the engine is turned off, you have electric car, your car is in the garage and it's being recharged and you're consuming energy. So where are we going? If we're going to clean energy, what are we going to do to power it?
Yeah, the electric utilities, they see electric vehicles as a big growth driver in years ahead. And, charging at night means one of two things. It means that batteries have to get cheaper and cheaper, and there have to be a lot of battery installations. Or it means, natural gas, nuclear power. It means I think the future is pretty bright for natural gas in the utilities. You're not going to see enough backup power in the form of batteries be able to put online and allow all these electric vehicles to charge overnight. I mean, that will require a massive, massive investment. And while that long term, that probably is the future, it's not the future in the short term. You know, I just don't think we've got enough batteries and projects in the pipeline to cover that, which is why I think natural gas is still in a pretty good position going forward.
So who are the major players in natural gas? Is it still the big boys?
Yeah, mostly. EQT was the largest natural gas producer in the country, and I think that is still the case. Their stock price has just gotten battered in recent years because of natural gas prices. And the irony is, as oil prices have recovered, natural gas prices are getting creamed again. You know, if you look at the oil prices today, you see that natural gas prices are down sharply. The reason for that is a lot of our natural gas production is from associated gas associated with oil production. And so anything that helps the oil industry produce more oil is also going to put more natural gas supplies on the market. And that's tending to depress the price.
How do these companies make money with natural gas prices this low?
They don't make good money. The break even for some of these companies is pretty low, the break even cost, but you know, they're not making good money here. And that's why their stock price, you know, like EQT, I think in the past 2 or 3 years down 75%. That is sort of indicative of the performance across all these natural gas producers. They've all gotten really hammered as a result of, you know, just too much natural gas production in the U.S. Our demand is up sharply. I mean, demand in the U.S. for natural gas is growing sharply, but production has stayed ahead of that. And so it's kept prices depressed.
So, Robert, what does this mean ultimately for OPEC? I mean, we had the price war between 2014, 2016. That was a disaster. Saudi Arabia tried to do it again. That turned out to be a disaster. If we are going towards clean energy, and if this is what it means for the big oil guys, what does this mean for OPEC?
Yeah, ultimately, OPEC has a not bright future. But, you know, how long will that be? They've probably got a few more years. And, they're still calling the shots for now. You know, if they hadn't finally come to some agreement and started cutting production, oil prices would still be, you know, in the teens or, you know, maybe even under $10. But, you know, what's driven oil price recovery is OPEC making the cuts. We've had a little bit of bounce back in demand. And then the rig count in the U.S. has just plummeted. So, those three factors have helped drive a recovery. But had OPEC not made the major cuts, then, I think oil prices would still be languishing. So, OPEC is still in a powerful position here. But, yeah, longer term, I think they'd like to sell as much of that oil as they can at a reasonable price. I think they don't want to sell it at $10 because over the long haul, it will be needed, just not at the sort of levels it's needed at today because of what we talked about, all the other things that oil is needed in, there will be an ongoing need for jet fuel. I don't think we'll ever see solar powered airplanes. It's just the physics are really problematic there. So, you know, it may be always that liquid fuels are the best way to fuel an airplane, a jet. I think there'll always be a demand. It's just, you know, it may be smaller in the future.
Well, it seems like we're moving more electric. I'm a sailor, and now they have sailboats that have electric engines on them, believe it or not, instead of diesel. So it goes to show you where we're going. Well, listen, Robert, you cover utilities, you cover energy. Would you avoid this space right now? I mean, just simply walk away and there's better opportunities elsewhere? What would you be doing?
Yeah, it depends on what kind of investor you are. If you've got a high risk tolerance, the thing is, energy has now recovered nicely from March, so you're not looking at real big bargains anymore. The utility sector has underperformed. I mean, they've underperformed this year because of all the stay-at-home orders. You saw a shift in demand for electricity, and that kind of had a chilling effect on the overall utility industry. You're going to probably see a short-term hit to profits. Now, for the regulated utilities, they're going to go and they're going to ask for a rate increase, and they will probably get them. But, you know, investors are a bit concerned that in the short term, they're going to take a profit hit. But that's caused utilities to underperform. They haven't seen the same kind of recovery as the oil industry, let's say. So I think there are some opportunities there in utilities, and you know, that's a more conservative space for investors to get into. You know, if you're a retiree or something, I would definitely recommend utilities over oil and gas. And there's still bargains in the midstream space. I think you could still go in and get an enterprise products for a reasonable price, although it's twice the price it was in March. It's still a year ago, it was significantly higher than it is now. So, and they're continuing to increase their cash flow. We're going to see a terrible quarter this quarter, the worst quarter probably we've ever seen in our lifetimes. But they haven't cut their dividend. They've indicated that they're going to try to avoid cutting their dividend. A few have already, a few of the more leveraged companies. But midstream overall is probably, you know, if you want to invest in oil and gas and you're an income investor, that's not a bad place to be if you can stand the volatility.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, you're a prolific writer. You write for Forbes, Investor's Business Daily, and you have a newsletter. If listeners would like to follow you, how can they do so, please?
Yeah, so I do write a weekly column at Forbes. So you can Google Robert Rapier and Forbes, and it'll take you right to my profile and my articles. So Investing Daily, I write one free article a week. Every Tuesday, it's on their homepage. That's just general personal finance. But then I do write Utility Forecaster. That is a monthly publication, 6,000 words, 12 pages. We make specific investment recommendations, sell a lot of covered calls so people can double up dividends. That's a big theme of mine for income investors who are getting a 4-5% dividend. I teach them how to double that and get, you know, 8-10%. And that really adds up over time. So that's Utility Forecaster. It's a monthly, but I also have a weekly column that subscribers get every week on specific coverage of utilities, and not just utilities, but income producing investments. Cover, consumer staples and oil and gas and REITs and MLPs and so forth.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, as always, thanks for joining us on the program, and come back again.
All right. Sounds good. Have a great day.
You too. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
Are you getting closer to retirement? Do you worry about what retirement will look like? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help put your mind at ease. Our advisors can help customize an individual retirement plan that fits your needs and helps you get on the right track to achieving your retirement goals. We'll show you how to get the most out of your Social Security benefits, make the right decisions on Medicare, reduce taxes, and increase your return on investments so you can relax and enjoy your retirement years. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
As Ryan mentioned at the beginning of today's show, the economic data for this week was mostly on the positive side, with some exceptions, and continues to show that things are generally moving in the right direction as states reopen for business. Well, in today's Big Picture segment, we are, as always, going to try and help you, our listeners, see the big picture. So, Jim, let's start today's program, which we have titled Phase 2 Relapse or Recovery, and I believe there may be a question mark on the end of that.
Yeah, a little bit of a question mark, Chris. I mean, you know, the good news is as more and more states are reopening their economy, things are starting to pick up. I mean, you can look at some of the economic numbers. This week is a good example. The Conference Board's leading economic indicators, still in sort of the negative territory, but it was up 2.5% in May. We got a whopping jump in retail sales last month, up 18%, and almost a quarter of that was new cars. So, Chris, people are seeing their bank accounts bulging. They're going out shopping for cars, and we'll get to one of the reasons why. And also this week, unemployment claims edged lower. They're down to about 1.5 million, and that is down from a peak at 6.9 million in March. So things are going in the right direction. So the real questions going forward, like in our own state of here, California, the governor just issued a edict on Thursday, basically saying everybody, if you're out in public, You have to have masks on. As everything reopens, we are seeing an increase in some of the COVID cases, but it is also related to there's more testing that's going on. So, you know, whether we get a second wave in the flu season, which begins at the end of September, and, you know, that's the big question. How does this recovery look like? And we're going to get into what Fed officials are saying and what's going on in Washington. But at least, Chris, for now, it looks like, you know, we've hit a bottom and we're working our way out.
Yeah, Jim, as you said, we're starting to see a little bit of an uptick in some of the COVID infections. We just got a notification this week for us in San Diego County that we have seen community outbreaks trigger as masks become mandatory across California. And the notice that was sent out was saying that there have been 8 outbreaks of COVID-19 identified over a 7-day period, surpassing the threshold of no more than 7. And so that is what has triggered the mandatory use of masks whenever you are out in public. And of course, for many of us living in the United States that have not had to deal with pandemics or diseases spreading on a much more regular basis, as you see in other places around the world, wearing a mask is something that's just not comfortable, not used to it. But of course, we are having to change a lot of the different ways in which we do things. And obviously, we're going to get into that today when we think about social distancing, a lot of the effects that that's having. But let's talk about some of the stimulus that you expect is necessary in this environment. Because again, we're not just going to jump back to normal all of a sudden. There has to be a bridge provided here to keep some of these businesses afloat. So let's talk about some of the stimulus measures you're looking at.
Yeah. One of the things that really happened with this shutdown, Chris, is you're talking about for the first time in history, we had the entire nation on lockdown. And I'm talking about healthy people as well as sick people. And right now, this is turning out to be, you know, looking like a very, very bad flu season when you take a look at the number of people that have been hit. You know, most people don't realize in a regular year, a bad flu season, 60 to 80,000 people die. We don't think much of it because it's just a normal thing. So until we have some kind of vaccine, until we have maybe some kind of miracle drug that they can use that can cure you if you get it, I think you're going to see this possibility that a lot of these states aren't going to open up fully in the terms of restaurants, movie theaters, gyms, even retail establishments. So that's why you're likely to see more stimulus coming. Now, there's one bill that's already passed the House by the Democrats. That is a $3 trillion stimulus package. The Republicans are working on their version. That could be a $1 trillion stimulus package. And then they're also working on a $1 trillion infrastructure package. So one of the problems with the PPP plan, which was the payroll protection plan, is the hardest hit companies, small businesses, were left empty-handed. They either had to close down. I don't think anybody thought, and Chris, you know, we were thinking about this even as an office. You remember, what was it, the first week in March when we went to teleworking, we were thinking, okay, maybe sometime in April, maybe May 1st, then it's June, and, you know, we are now just voluntary having people come back with a rotational shift in July. But who knows if that's going to happen? So what happened is a lot of businesses just simply could not make it. You just can't shut a business down for 4 months. And if they don't have any revenues or they had a hard time getting revenues, it just, there were some of these businesses were small businesses and they just had fewer customers. They couldn't afford to stay open. There was, I don't know if I've shared this with my listeners, there's a Legree studio in Poway that was doing very, very well. And basically, they got shut down after 4 months. You know what? They're not going to reopen. A big gym company around here locally, 24-Hour Fitness, just filed for bankruptcy. Gold's Gym filed for bankruptcy. And a lot of these businesses and the way they configured PPP is for a lot of these businesses, one of their biggest expenses. There was a story in the Wall Street Journal about a yoga studio chain where they're in big cities like New York, but their biggest expense was rent. It wasn't payroll, because a lot of their yoga instructors were kind of independent contractors. So their biggest expense was rent, and the PPP plan didn't cover enough of that. And on top of that, Chris, it was very, very complicated. There were a lot of complaints. People, if you were a small business and maybe didn't do business with the big banks, you had trouble getting it. And so a lot of this, you know, you could say it helped. The unemployment rate might have been much worse. But also the stimulus plan has made it where it's actually more profitable not to work. You know, if you're making minimum wage in some states at 15 or 17, this has been Amazon's biggest complaint. You know, they're paying $17 and they're competing against unemployment, which is $23 with the extra $600 a month. So we're going to see more stimulus. It's just a question, when will it pass and what's it going to look like in a compromise? It's kind of like a sausage factory. And in order to get both sides to go along with it, a lot of times you get something that really doesn't look that good.
So bottom line, Jim, we are seeing a recovery in the process. Things are continuing to improve. We could maybe say it's two steps forward, one step back. But the bigger issue here is that we're not going to return back to a normal state of economic activity that we saw pre-COVID because of the social distancing measures, because of the number of changes that have to take place. I mean, even if you just think about kids at school nowadays, you know, I have two kids, they're in elementary school. When they go back in the fall, it's not going to be school is normal. There's probably going to be a staggered is what they're talking about, where some kids go to school on these days, other kids go to school on, you know, odd or even days. So that means during those off days, you have kids at home. So then parents are going to either have to find childcare, that's going to be an additional expense, or they're going to have to work from home. So there's a number of different ripple effects and changes that mean we're not returning back to business as usual immediately, which again means the government is going to have to provide stimulus as a buffer for that loss of economic activity until we get back to some semblance of normalcy. And as you probably saw, I believe it was this week or last week, the Congressional Budget Office said that they're not expecting the U.S. economy to get back to pre-COVID trendline growth until the end of this decade.
Well, I mean, even if you take a look at the Fed governors, they're saying it may be 2023 until we get back to something that looks somewhat normal. And I've seen 2025, 2026, end of the decade before this, you know, we get back to anything that looked like the way the economy looked like in January before all this hit. I mean, if you think about this year, Chris, just in the first 6 months, we began February with the impeachment of a president. We haven't seen that since 1998. Then we began with COVID, and then we began with rioting and looting. I mean, we have seen more things, and they're expecting another big event, as normally happens in the month of September and October, just before the election. So, you know, who knows what's going to happen? But, you know, stimulus in government spending, we are seeing MMT being implemented, which is modern monetary theory, which basically says as long as you can issue debt in your own currency, you can issue as much as you want, and the Fed will simply print it. In fact, you even have Jerome Powell at the Fed that is begging Congress for more stimulus. The Fed is going into the marketplace, they just announced this week, $250 billion that they're going to buy in corporate bonds, $500 billion that they're going to use to finance new corporate debt. So there are $750 billion. And then the Fed is buying massive amounts of treasuries and mortgages, and they're simply running out. Now, the good thing is the government is spending a lot of money, which means it's a lot of debt. But Powell says, basically, the Fed is saying we need more fiscal stimulus because monetary stimulus is down at zero. There's only so much it can do. And that's why the Fed is urging it. There's members in Congress that are urging it and realizing. So it's just a question now of political philosophy. One side wants to extend unemployment benefits And we're going to, and I'll tell you one reason why that's not going to work as effectively. Now, let's just talk about this because it's a big argument between both parties. Chris, if I give you money.
How much are you going to give me, Jim? Let's talk numbers here.
Well, whatever you want, dude. $4,000 or $5,000 a month, you know, you name it.
Sounds good.
Okay. But, you know, if I'm giving you money and it's more money than you would get working, you know, just look at it economically. Why in the heck would you want to work? Now, one of the problems about transfer payments is as long as you keep giving somebody transfer payments, they have money to spend. The minute you stop those transfer payments, they no longer have money to spend. So that's one argument. The other argument is if we can create something that will get you to go back to work, there's two or three things that are going to happen if you go back to work and you have a job. Number one, if you have a job, you're either producing something in manufacturing or in service. Number two, you have money to spend. Number three, if you're working, you're also providing tax revenues to the government. So it's a more efficient way of trying to create incentives that get businesses to hire more workers, to expand and get people back to work versus keeping people on transfer payments. I mean, you know, why not? Why would somebody want to go work at $17 an hour, $15 an hour, when they can get $23 an hour for not working? I mean, it's simple economics. You know, if I was unemployed and I was, let's say, making minimum wage $17, $18, and I can make $23 on unemployment, why would I want to go to work? Where's the incentive? So there's a couple things. They're talking about lowering payroll taxes for businesses and workers. So that would encourage people. There is talk about extension of unemployment, but some kind of incentive that would be created that if you leave unemployment and go back to work, there's a talk about aid to the states. A lot of states, they can't print money like the Fed. They're running huge deficits. Our own state of California can't meet unemployment claims without loans from the government. And that's not just California. It's Illinois. It's New Jersey and New York, several other states. And then there's also a $1 trillion infrastructure bill. So, you know, the thing I want to give you the impression, stimulus spending is going to be massive. Deficits are going to be massive. In the next 2 years, we're going to be over $30 trillion in debt, which is another reason they're going to try to keep interest rates down with financial repression, which is bad news if you're a pension fund, a retiree, a foundation, or an investor, because rates are going to be low. And unlike the last time when the Fed went in with QE, Chris, they were buying treasuries in mortgage-backed securities. This time, the Fed is going in. They're buying commercial paper. They're backstopping money market funds. They're buying corporate bonds, junk bonds. So it's not just treasury debt. They're going into the corporate bond market in an effort to drive down interest rates so credit spreads don't blow out. Because what happens in a recession? Normally, lower quality debt, interest rates rise to reflect the risk of recession and default. So the Fed is trying to prevent that by going into the market and buying corporate debt. So they're lowering the interest rates on corporate debt. Normally, right now, we would be talking about high single-digit interest rates with the kind of unemployment and economic contraction that we're seeing now. And you saw that in the corporate debt markets during the financial crisis of 2007 and 2009. You started to see this in March, which is why the Fed's mandate changed, and they're moving into the corporate debt market. So, Chris, monetary stimulus, fiscal stimulus, they're going to be here for a long, long time.
So as we discussed in our March 27th show, the Fed and the U.S. government dropped the mother of all stimulus bombs in the wake of the economy-wide shutdown by the government. And so now it sounds like we're looking at carpet bombing for the next, I don't know, 2-3 years, however long it takes for us to get out of this. But essentially, we're going to be seeing lots and lots of stimulus being dropped on the economy for quite a while.
Oh, absolutely. And the recovery is going to take years to come back to normal with vast amounts of stimulus. I mean, one of the main reasons there have been hundreds and hundreds of thousands of businesses that have simply been destroyed as a result of the lockdown. These businesses aren't coming back. And even the ones that are coming back, I mean, if you take a look at here in California, they're operating at a fraction of capacity. A lot of restaurants, I was talking to my son last night. He and his wife went to a restaurant, Chris. They were not allowed to go indoors into the restaurant. So what the restaurant did is they set out tables outside in the parking lot. They tried to put AstroTurf down to kind of give you the feeling you just weren't sitting on a parking lot. But they were operating at a fractional capacity, probably 25% of what they normally do. AMC, which filed for bankruptcy, the largest movie theater chain, they're hoping to open up July 24th with some major movies, but they're saying they're only going to be allowing the theater to fill up 30% capacity. They don't see full capacity to maybe November or December, and that really depends on whether we get a second wave of the coronavirus this fall. So restaurants, social distancing, less air travel, there are a lot of things that just aren't going to be the same. And we did an interview with Dr. Lori Pennington Gray. She's a professor and researcher at the University of Florida. She's also director of the Tourism Crisis Management Center. And what they did is they wanted to look at how people are changing what they do, how they travel, how they take vacations. And I want to go over a couple of these because this is rather interesting. One of the surveys they showed, people plan on not making any plans for travel for at least 2 to 6 months. And if you remember after 9/11, it almost took a full year before people were getting back on airplanes. Another study they had, this is rather interesting, and it does not bode well for many types of businesses. So then they asked the question, you know, if you were to travel, how would you travel? The majority, well over 50%, said they would travel by car, not by plane. Then they asked, what type of accommodation are you most likely to book for your next holiday? Two biggest spots, hotels, all suite hotels, not good for Airbnb in some of the smaller establishments. Boy, I tell you, I'd hate to be a cruise operator. Chris, what do you think cruise, the number of people when they were talking about what kind of vacation are you going to take? What do you think it was for cruises?
Let's say 10%.
1%.
Wow. That's pretty low.
Yeah. And this isn't good for Vegas and casinos. Only 4.7% said they would go to a casino. Number one spot by far was the beach and also public and national parks. So cruises, 1%. Casinos, 5%. Lake cottage, 7%. Now, here's one I found interesting. Big cities, 15%. So you can just see this is, you know, what we've gone through this year is one of those seminal events that you experience in a lifetime that shapes behavior and business for almost a whole generation. Think of what the Great Depression and World War II did for the boomers' parents, the greatest generation. Think of what the 60s did to the boomers. And think of what this is doing to millennials. This is one of those events that's going to shape a lot of things for a decade to come. And I think that's why probably the CBO said it's probably going to be a decade before this all works out.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. I mean, when you think about just how rapid the change was to society, trends that were probably already in place, you know, I mean, you think about working from home. With all the range of tools and technology that's now available to us with, you know, the ability to teleconference, to do video chats. I mean, all these things that we now have at our fingertips that allow us to work from home. These were a tailwind for that trend to take place, you know, and normally it probably would have been something that we would have seen a massive shift in the way in which we work and where we work over many years. But now we've seen this change overnight, you know, just within the span of really a couple weeks as everyone shut down and like with our own company, we are all working from home. There was a recent survey, this was posted on Business Insider, from S&P Global Market Intelligence, where they polled 575 IT decision makers from a range of industries. And the survey said that 67%, so over two-thirds of respondents, expect work-from-home policies will remain in place permanently, or at least for the long term. That's astounding. I mean, especially when you think about just the impact that's going to have on commercial real estate, right? I mean, what do you do with all those office buildings now?
Yeah, this is, one of the things that we've talked about here and some of our guests on the program is COVID is going to accelerate trends that were already in place prior to COVID. Retail, less shopping malls. Howard Davidowitz said basically 50% of all retail space shopping centers will disappear over the next decade because America is the most overbuilt shopping place in the world. So that trend is going to accelerate. Amazon is preparing for it. They're already hiring 125,000 workers. You're going to see more stores that do make it, whether it's, you know, the stores, the big box stores that are doing well, your Costco's, your Walmart's, your Target's have transitioned to an online business, pickup business. You're even seeing a local grocery store here, Chris, has six car lanes up front in front of the store for pickup. So you don't even have to walk in the store. That's going to accelerate. A lot of businesses are finding they don't have to go to conferences. You can do it through Zoom or Teams with Microsoft. So less hotel travel, less business travel, which means less use of airlines, less commercial space. Several large national firms have announced that they're getting rid of a lot of their commercial office space. The insurance industry is doing this. A lot of their agents can work out of their house. They don't need an office. And the other thing I think you're going to see, and you've seen this with the jump in the savings rate, people are going to be more circumspect about spending money. And the reason they're going to do that, because there's more uncertainty out there. The second thing is interest rates are at zero. If you're a retiree, if you're a pension fund, if you're investing in your 401k, all the rates of return on traditional safe type investments, whether it's treasuries, treasury bills, CDs, even short-term high-quality corporate bonds, the rates of return are under 1% to under 2%. I mean, so people know that, you know, if you're only making 1% or 2% or less than 1% on your money, it doesn't take a genius mathematically to figure out, I'm going to have to put aside more money if I want to reach my retirement goals, education goals for my children. So savings are going to increase.
Jim, one of the past themes and topics that we've discussed on the show a number of times is the fact that, you know, we see these platform companies. So that can be Apple, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, right? They provide now an essential service, especially in the wake of COVID. Tell us a little bit about the land of the giants theme and where you see this headed.
Yeah, this was something we first brought up on the show back in 2014, and it was the consolidation that we were seeing in just about every major industry. You take airlines, there's really mainly two, Airbus and Boeing. You're down to fewer car companies. You're down to fewer industrial companies. You're down to fewer drug companies. Just about every place you go, you're seeing this consolidation. And this was going back to 2014. At that time, there were 1,400 companies, 80% of them Western, that controlled almost 60% of the world's GDP. If you take a look at the Russell 5000, it's no longer the Russell 5000. There's barely 3,000 companies left because of all the M&A activity. And what happens when you see this consolidation? Companies end up becoming oligopolies. What does that do? It means it reduces competition. If you have less competition, what does that mean? It means you can raise prices, your margins are higher, your return on equity is higher. So this is a trend, Chris, that's going to continue. You know, we may get down to only the Russell 2000 by the end of the decade. There's just going to be fewer companies out there. Those that are around and make it through this period are going to be stronger financially, and they're going to be bigger. So that trend is going to continue. But another one I see that's going to happen. And we've talked about this with the experts on our program. In fact, last week with Kathy Fetke, is a demographic shift. People are going to be moving to low tax, low cost states. They're also going to be looking to smaller towns. And especially as you see this anarchy that we're seeing in large cities from New York, Chicago, Seattle to LA, because people just aren't going to feel safe. And especially if some of the mayors and governors begin to move to defund the police department, it's just too much anarchy and too much risk out there. So people are going to be moving for a number of reasons. If you're retired, you're going to move to a place where it's cheaper to live. So whether it's housing, taxes, medical. Secondly, people are going to start, you're going to see suburbia grow. People are going to want, they're not going to want to be in these big cities where there's risk. You know, just turn on your nightly television and watch the news of what you're seeing. If you're watching that and you're thinking of retiring, are you going to want to stay in a big city? I doubt it. So you're going to see this transition to smaller towns. And as we open up with the internet infrastructure and 5G, that's going to make that even more possible. So a demographic shift is also going to happen. So a lot of things are going to happen as a result of all of this. These trends are going to accelerate. It's going to be a totally different world, Chris, if we were to wake up 10 years from now, looking at the way the economy functions, what businesses survived. You know, there's still going to be gyms. They're not going to be as prolific. You know, there's certain people that like going to gyms. They're taking steps to make them safer. But I mean, the home gym equipment market is booming. I have a friend that's the founder of one of the major gym equipment makers in the country. And their retail business, they're backlogged for several months. I mean, if you want to see this, go on Amazon, try to get a set of dumbbells, exercise bands, or any kind of exercise equipment, and you're going to wait a long period of time. So the world that we're looking at today is going to look totally different 10 years from now.
So Jim, just to recap some of the things that we've discussed so far, the economic data is continuing to improve. It's not going to go back to normal anytime soon unless the government decides and states decide that we're going to completely relax all of the measures. But that said, we are seeing major shifts in consumer activity, consumer behavior, working from home. There's a shift that is taking place in society from the bottom up that even if the government were to say, oh, you know, let's completely relax all restrictions and allow you to go back to the way you were, we're not going to go back to the way we were. The genie is already out of the bottle. And so because of that, you know, we're not going to see the normal levels of economic activity that we were used to pre-COVID for months, probably years to come. That means there's going to be more stimulus for quite a while, continued carpet bombings, as we said, you know, the mother of all stimulus bombs that was dropped in March. So that's kind of the big picture that we need to look at. And one of the things you mentioned earlier, uncertainties, right? Uncertainty is such a huge thing when you think about investor sentiment and uncertainty over the future, uncertainty over the elections. And so here's one of the key risks, I think, that we have to all keep in mind, not just the risk of a second wave, as you mentioned, and outbreaks in certain areas, as China saw another outbreak, and that caused a little bit of a stir, but also the risk of a policy mistake. And that's a pretty big one. So what are your thoughts on that when it comes to understanding the big picture?
Yeah, and we can see this. We can look at policy mistakes either on the fiscal side or on the monetary side. I don't think you're going to see a risk on the monetary side. Notice when the Fed raised interest rates four times in 2018, and they saw the impact it was starting to do to the economy, how quickly they flipped at the beginning of 2019. And we went from raising interest rates, they didn't call it QE at the time, but now it is QE. I mean, they're basically printing $1 trillion a month. And to put that into perspective, the last QE, which was the biggest following the financial crisis, we'll call it QE3, was $1.6 trillion. That was over almost a year and a half. Now, we're printing $1 trillion a month. So I don't see that as a risk. The biggest risk I see is on the fiscal side, And one of the best examples I could give you is the Great Depression. President Roosevelt came in 1933, set up FDIC to shore up the banking system, devalued the currency, basically gold. Gold went from $20 to $35 an ounce, and he confiscated it, got rid of deflation, spent a ton of money with the New Deal program. The stock market took off, was up almost over 400%. The economy began to grow. Unemployment came down. And then in 1937, the government began to cut back on spending. They raised tax rates to 90%, which just basically choked off the economy. And the Fed began raising interest rates. And so we were right back into a Great Depression and double-digit, over 20% unemployment until World War II. I don't think you're going to see the Fed do that. But there is the risk of taxes. I mean, if we look at this election now, Biden just announced his tax plan. He's going to raise taxes $4 trillion. He wants to raise the corporate tax rate from 21 to 28. He wants to raise capital gains taxes from 10, 15, and 20 to 28%, and also on dividends. Tax rates he would raise to 50 to 70%. Estate taxes, he would lower the exemption, which is about 11.4 million, down to roughly about 3.5 million. Now, hopefully, if we're still in double-digit unemployment rates, that his advisors would say, yeah, you might not want to do that. And the reason I bring this up is President Obama did not raise taxes until after he got reelected in his second term, and he raised them in the fourth quarter of 2012, where they went into effect in 2013, and predictably, it slowed down the rate of growth. But the economy was growing, and that's an important thing to understand. When you have economic growth, you can better absorb a shock, whether it's a geopolitical shock or some kind of economic event. When you are in a recession, when you have high unemployment, the last thing you want to do is raise taxes. So that could be a policy mistake. So you have no idea. I know President Obama ran on a platform of raising taxes, but he had smart enough economic advisors that basically said, Mr. President, you can't do that right now. We have 10% unemployment. If you do that, you're going to kill the economy. So he waited till he won re-election in a second term. So we simply don't know that. And as Gina Martin Adams and I were talking earlier on in the program, that's one of the big policy risks that we're going to look at. What are they going to do on taxes? What are they going to do on trade? What are they going to do on fiscal stimulus? Who's going to be the next president of the United States? Who's going to control Congress? All these are big unknowns going forward. And as long as you have that great uncertainty about the only thing that's driving things right now is Fed policy, because unless they come up with another stimulus, which I think they're going to prior to the election, that's what we're going to have to look at. There's just too much uncertainty for this to be the V-shaped recovery, which what a lot of economists are talking about, especially when we saw the jump in 18% in retail sales.
Yeah, when it came to the future uncertainty over policy measures, and especially the battle that we're going to be looking at between Trump and Biden in the coming months, when it comes to just how should we be dealing with the economic environment, that was a key reason why Martin Armstrong, who we spoke with on FS Insider this week, believe that we're probably near a market high about now, and that he thinks we're going to see weakness into the lead up of the elections because of this massive uncertainty. When you think about just how different policy is going to be between Trump on the one hand and Biden on the other, especially if Biden were to fall more along the lines of Obama era policies, whereas Trump, as we all know, radically changed that, lowering corporate tax rates, lowering the amount of regulations that small businesses are under, the likes of which we haven't seen since Reagan. So quite two divergent outcomes that we would see. So it was because of that uncertainty that Martin Armstrong believes we're going to probably see some weakness up until September, October. And I do want to note, when we spoke with him in March, it was March 18th, he had predicted that we would see the market bottom at the end of March with an end of quarter liquidation, and that we would see a strong bounce back rally in the market up until right around the June, July timeframe. So he was dead on his forecast when we spoke with him in March. And now at this point, he's basically getting a little cautious. So very interesting comments from him this week on FS Insider. So Jim, given that, what are some of the things that you think investors or the market isn't either aware of or they're not looking at right now?
I think the two biggest things that nobody's expecting, Chris, and I'm probably going to write another article. I wrote one article about, instead of oil glut, an oil shock. I'm still holding to that view. So higher oil prices, you're going to see in the next 2 years the plunge in U.S. oil production that's coming out of shale. I mean, shale production increased U.S. production by almost 8 million barrels a day. We went from 5 to almost 13 at the peak. We're probably heading back down more to 8, which means we're going to be importing more oil. Oil is going to get more expensive, and that's going to be inflationary. And that brings up the second thing the market isn't expecting, which is inflation. And I expect to see both. You know, it was interesting. The other night I was in the store, and there was an older gentleman, and he was in the meat department, and he was looking, and he looked over to me, and he made a comment. He said, "I have never seen meat prices this high." And he was looking at two ribeye steaks that wasn't even prime. It was choice, $46. So you're going to see it in food cost. You're going to see it in restaurants. You're going to see it in energy cost. You're going to see it in goods cost. It's going to be reflected, because if you have fewer customers, how are you going to make your business profitable? You're going to have to raise prices. So restaurant prices are going up. Food prices are going up at the fastest level we've seen in years. The disruption of supply chains is going to make it more expensive. So the two things nobody's expecting is inflation and higher oil prices.
And Jim, when it comes to the shift to inflation, very interesting note, Russell Napier, who we've had on our show numerous times in the past, as you know, he has argued for a deflationary outlook for many, many years and taken the side of deflation. He just recently came out with a piece where he says that we are now entering the age of inflation. So he has made a big turn in his view, and we're going to have him on the show pretty soon to talk about that. So that is a noted deflationist now saying you got to be worried about inflation. With that said, and that, you know, you think as well, inflation is ahead of us. What do investors do when we think about retirees, companies, pension funds? What do they do in this environment?
In this kind of environment, Chris, because our debt is becoming so massive, the Fed is going to use financial repression to keep interest rates at low and zero. And like I said, this time they're intervening in the corporate debt market. At least after the financial crisis, you could get somewhat decent yields in the corporate market. That is disappearing. So there's going to be a search for yield. And it's one of the reasons we came up with our income account, which is about 60% high dividend paying blue chip stocks, where the dividend yields are running between 3 and 6%. We've got preferred stocks, 5.5% to 6.5%, and then we have some hedges and short-term bonds. But the yield is almost 4.5%. I mean, you compare that to a treasury, 10-year treasury at 0.7%, or a 30-year bond at 1.4, or corporate bonds at 2. And that's why we came up with this, because I wrote about this in the fall of 2019 in a seminar I gave for our clients, because we could see this coming. The other thing that corporations are going to have to deal with is 0% interest rates. So we manage the cash balance for several large companies. So we have a corporate cash management account, because what do companies do? You can't put it all in the bank because it's not all insured. If you go into a treasury money market fund, you're getting zero. In fact, in one case, we looked at a corporate money market fund, and we had to point out that half of the bonds in the portfolio were repos with very unstable European banks, because the fund managers were looking for yields. So it is going to be a search for yield. And Chris, I there was a trend. I talked about it in the last decade, the bubble in index funds and passive investing. And I think that period of time is over. It's going to take more active management, which is what we're doing. One of the reasons we were able to sidestep a lot of what happened this year. And it reminds me of an old saying that quip from Will Rogers, the comedian. And he once said, and I think this applies to this kind of market and passive indexing, you can be on the right track, but if you stay there long enough, you'll eventually get run over. And that's what happened to a lot of index investors this year. So I think a search for yield, active management, and looking for safer places and you're going to have to shift on how you look at investing. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on this extended program today. There's just so much happening, folks, and we're going to try to keep you up to date with our guest and also with future programs. Listen to the program we have coming out on Monday, where I interviewed Lori Pennington Gray. She's a professor and researcher at the University of Florida. She's a director of tourism and crisis management. In fact, Chris, let's put her slide deck on the website so you can take a look at this. I think you're going to find this fascinating, not only from an investment perspective, but what is on the minds of people. They update this survey weekly, and I think you'll find it a fascinating read.
And just a reminder, folks, that you can listen to Financial Sense NewsHour on our website, financialsense.com, or also on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. As always, please do tell your friends and family about Financial Sense NewsHour. To give you a heads up on what we're discussing next week, we're going to have Ben Phillips, the creator of the Policy ETF, PLCY, to discuss the variety of ways in which you can invest around government policy in our post-COVID world, whether or not that's healthcare, technology, infrastructure, and a wide range of different areas. We're also going to be speaking with Chris Whalen to get his outlook on the commercial real estate sector, which, as we discussed today, is likely going to be impacted very hard by the largest work from home experiment in world history, especially when we think about how many companies are likely to keep their employees working from home for an extended period of time, if not forever. So what is that going to do to commercial real estate? What is that going to do to local and state finances and some of the other ripple effects that could come from that? Chris Whalen is an expert in this area, so definitely listen to hear what he has to say on FS Insider next week. If you want to get your hands on that information, again, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button. If you'd like to give us a call at Financial Sense Wealth Management to discuss with us our own investment outlook and what we are specifically doing for clients, you can give us a call at 888-486-3939.
On behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the program. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.